You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's a given that New York City is a melting pot and that a lot of different ethnicities have been added to the mix over time. Now Colin Quinn has taken it upon himself to dissect the various groups that have left their mark on our town over the centuries in a laugh-filled one-man show at the Cherry Lane Theater in Greenwich Village. It's called Colin Quinn, The New York Story, and it's directed by Jerry Seinfeld. I'm very pleased to welcome back to our show the man Chris Rock calls the white Richard Pryor. Hello, Colin.
Thanks. Hi, Leonard.
I should also mention that you have written a book called The Coloring Book for Grand Central Publishing. Which was harder to do, writing the book or writing the play?
Well, they both became, they started to inform them each other, you know what I mean? Like, but the book was harder at first because being a comedian, I didn't realize I'm spoiled. I'm not used to writing and getting no feedback. So, you know, an editor's going to go, hey, that was pretty good. Like, so I had to start performing what I wrote before I could actually make the book happen.
Well, you also get laughs from tone of voice, and you don't have a tone of voice on the printed page.
No, it's brutal. Books are really hard.
Should I be concerned that in the course of your three one-man shows, your scope keeps getting smaller? You've gone from tackling the whole world, and long story short, and then the country in Unconstitutional, and here you are dealing just with New York City.
Yeah. Well, I originally did a show back in the 90s called Irish Wake, which was about my block. So maybe I'll do that one next and then do only about myself.
Didn't you tour the country with one of your previous shows?
Yeah, Unconstitutional. I toured the whole country.
And how did that go?
I went to all 13 colonies. I thought it was a real clever idea. Didn't really catch on like the wildfire I hoped it did, but it did well.
Well, you must have mentioned it to everybody.
Of course, I mentioned it to everybody I could. But that was an interesting show. It was interesting to see, our country now is so, in some ways, so generic, like that everybody has the same, everybody's like, oh, they must have not laughed at this there. And I was like, no, it's more like a cautious kind of laughter, but it's different.
But people outside of New York either want to be here or will say, I would never live in New York. Some of them are really almost hostile, and I'm not exactly sure why. They see New York as some kind of foreign place.
Yeah, I don't blame them for being hostile. We're pushy. We want to control all the ideas in the country. Us in L.A., at least we're smart. We should control some. L.A., they have nuts jumping on our, you know.
Well, they're in their cars. They can't argue with each other. Yeah. They can maybe crash every once
exactly.
in a while.
Exactly. It is a car thing. You're right.
This is the second time that Jerry Seinfeld has directed one of your shows. How did the two of you connect?
This time it was really about, like, he was interested, and I kept telling him about the show. He goes, you should do a show. Like, he kind of envisioned the show like 4 years ago. He goes, you should do a show because all I do is talk about ethnicity and neighborhoods. That's my favorite subject, you know. I go around. I mean, I literally went around everywhere. Sometimes I'll just go travel like one of those I have my own NPR show, but I don't, where you travel around to different neighborhoods and just hang out with people, you know. It's kind of creepy when you really say it out loud, but he was so fascinated, and then he just got on board.
Well, he's been talking a lot about political correctness recently, and to some degree, that's what this show is also about.
Sure. The second half feels like more like, well, I mean, just the fact that I'm saying it's ethnic. I'm saying that you can't talk about New York without identifying ethnicities and their differences. So just saying that alone is basically saying, hey, I disagree with the current non-conversation that people call a conversation.
What does being directed by Jerry Seinfeld even entail? Does he suggest jokes?
Sometimes he'll suggest jokes, suggest cuts. Sometimes he'll just have, he's just a linear thinker. Like, me and him are almost the exact opposite the way we think. And I'll be like working what I think is being clear. And he'll be like, I don't understand what you're saying. And then if a guy like Jerry Seinfeld goes, I don't understand what you're saying, he's a comedian like me. So if he doesn't understand what I'm saying, then I have to really look at it. I can't just be like, oh, you wouldn't get this joke because, you know.
So that helps you clarify your thinking.
Oh, yeah. He's a clear thinker, let's face it.
When you say you grew up in Park Slope these days, people must have a very different impression of what that must have been like, given that what Park Slope has
become.
That's
right, the Swiss village that we call it today.
How many different races were in the neighborhood when you were growing up?
Not many. Just black, white, Puerto Rican, and Chinese. Those were all you were allowed to be. If you tried to, like, identify yourself as, half Honduran, half Filipino, they would dismiss it. You know, no.
But it was heavily Irish on the one side of 9th Street.
That's right.
In fact, Pete Hamill has written a lot about growing
That's
up
right.
there. And what was relatively an Irish neighborhood, you don't see that at all in that neighborhood today.
No.
Except a couple of the older residents.
And maybe a little bit of Windsor Terrace. You know what I mean? Like Windsor Terrace still has a... But even that's not that Irish. But, you know, Farrell's and all that. Like the Irish, that little section was Irish until about 10 years ago, yeah.
Did you have friends of different races?
Yeah, sure we did. We played we played ball and went to school. And everybody was, you know, I talk about it in the book. It's like everybody was kind of pretty close in junior high school. But once you got to like age 15, people did more or less drift away from each other.
Do you think that those experiences shaped you as a comedian?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely, because... Because we the way we spoke to each other would be, you know, commission-forming moments for today, you know.
Race is such a politically volatile issue. It sounds like Wyatt Cenac is still worked up about a Jon Stewart skit from many years ago that he felt was stereotypical and insulting to blacks. If you want to talk about sensitive things, is there a way to avoid being offensive?
No, you know, I mean, comedy, it's like... this comedian Jack Simmons from years ago used to always say, folks, in the middle of his act, he made some joke. It wasn't racial. It was something about baby Jessica. That's how long ago it was. And the crowd, oh, and he goes, come on, folks, it's comedy. Somebody's got to get hurt.
In a recent interview I read with Don Rickles, he said that no one has ever really taken offense at his insults. How does he get away with them?
Because he's so funny. I mean, I'm sure some people have taken offense at him. But, I mean, yeah, he's just so funny and so... And at the end of his act, he's always like, listen, ladies and gentlemen, we joke, but let's, you know, he gives that big heartfelt thing at the end.
On the other hand, Joan Rivers, who came on the show a lot of times and actually sat in for me once, when she came here, there were always people who were very angry with her.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether it was because she's a woman or because she was doing something similar to what Don Rickles does.
Yeah, but she was more, like his thing was more... anachronistic in a certain way, whereas she was talking about everything that happened that week. And she was, you know, I mean, like, she had a lot of, I mean, Don Rickles is like everybody in, I mean, I love Don Rickles, but Joan Rivers had new material every week.
And what about you? Do you have to keep up, come up with new material all the time?
Yeah. I mean, that's part of being a comedian is like, you don't want to be the person that's talking about something and it's like, well, that's really kind of, that's from another time.
You being like, I mean? Baby Jessica.
What's that?
Like
Baby Jessica, exactly. Well, that's an extreme example, but I've seen, sometimes you hear an older comedian, he'll make a joke about like McMillan and wife in the 90s, and I was like, oh, you know.
They've been telling that same joke since it was their A material.
Right, right.
My guest is Colin Quinn, whose show, The New York Story, is currently at the Cherry Lane Theater at 38 Commerce Street, a wonderful theater, the oldest off-Broadway theater still in operation.
Amazing. So beautiful.
And it must be wonderful being up on that stage.
It's wonderful even being upstairs in the place because you think of like Samuel Beckett or, you know, Sam Shepard, like all these guys that did their things there. And it's just like, it's got, if you, I feel, maybe I'm imagining, but I feel the history in there, you know.
As you see it, when did things start to change in New York, or have they?
Yeah, they've changed. I mean, I feel like New York, I mean, it changed for the better at the same time. We were talking about the old days in New York. Like, the characters kind of went away, and it was partly their own fault because they left. Because a lot of those characters that we love, the typical New York characters, wanted to move to Long Island, you know? So, and people changed.
Because they said the schools were better.
Right, right. And it just, I mean, but I do feel that there's a certain, that people came here for a certain authenticity, and I feel like we've somehow started to parrot the rest of the country as far as the kind of vague, generalized platitudes and, you know, just speaking that kind of positivity that I really never associated with New York and never wanted to.
So the unique New York personality is gone or is leaving?
Yeah, the only ones that still have remnants of it are the immigrants that came here in the past 25 years.
That's on the other hand, there are so many people who feel that the city's improving, so could it be that you're just a grump?
Oh, that's definitely a very good possibility.
What about technology? What role has that been playing in the changes? There are no phone boxes on corners anymore, and I always worry about whether Clark Kent would be able to change into his Superman costume today.
Exactly. He'd have to wait online for a half hour at the Starbucks bathroom, right?
if it was open, in fact.
And then when he gets in there, he'd probably be like, oh, it's not worth it.
Was it hard to include each ethnicity in the book? Each one has left its mark both physically and on the soul of the city, but right. You almost feel like you have to give them equal treatment.
Yes. Well, I have to. I mean, the hard part is, like I said, there's a lot of, there's a million now. So I have to go sweeping near the end of the thing and talk about Africans as one group, even though Senegalese and Nigerians are two separate groups. And, you know, when I say Arabs, and I'm not talking about Afghanis, even though they have a little community in Flushing at the end of Main Street where it's all Afghanis. And so it's for all the other groups, but like I said, black, white, black, Puerto Rican, Jewish, Irish, Italian, like the first early ones I do a big chunk of.
You know? Historically, historians have said that New York has always been a place that has attracted outcasts because it was a place where whose real function was to make money. It was a business city.
Right.
People didn't come here to find freedom. They came here to make money.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously, there's a lot of greedy people in New York, too. It's become, you know, now it's even more of a, like, people don't even have to live here, and they kind of live here and make money here. So, I mean, it's a whole different ballgame. But I don't think that was true, like, throughout history.
They came here often to reinvent themselves.
That's L.A. People go into L.A. to reinvent themselves. I went to L.A. to reinvent. First time I went to L.A., I rented a Mercedes. That's what a phony I was.
So that people would think that you were wealthier than you were?
Just because I was like, hey, Mercedes. I didn't even know what Mercedes was. I just knew it. I heard it was good. So I was like, yeah, I'm going to have a Mercedes. I was a real idiot. It was probably the ugliest Mercedes in L.A. But if people come to New York, I mean, you can be anonymous here still, which is great. Like, you move one subway line and, you know, you have whole new friends.
Now, you talk a lot about stereotypes in the show. Do you think that many stereotypes are based on truths?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think all of them have, if they're funny, it's a sin. I don't think stereotype is a bad word. It's another word for stereotype would be like cultural, quality, like a quality that a person would have. But nowadays, I feel like people, if you are a cultural anthropologist today, that's synonymous. You might as well call yourself a racist because that's what it means nowadays.
I note that you wrote that you were a bit more cautious in your book with the Jewish section because you realized that they're the only ones who would ever read the book.
That's correct.
Do you agree with Lenny Bruce, who once said that everybody from New York is Jewish, whether they're Jewish or not, and nobody from outside New York can be Jewish, even if they are?
Yes, I do. I thought that was a very powerful statement.
Have you ever wanted to be something other than an Irish American?
Sure. I mean, over the course of your life, whenever, you know, different ages, you want to be different things. I wanted to, you know, when I was a kid, you want to be black, Puerto Rican, Italian, and then Jewish. I mean, I was the only, like, 8-10-year-old kid, just what a real comedian I was, that watched Jan Murray, if you remember Jan Murray.
I do.
And I used to run home for
lunch.
Didn't
he wind up with Lucille Ball at the end of
her
life?
I got to look that up.
Well, I'm probably wrong, and listeners are going to write in that stupid Lope, but I seem to remember that.
All I remember is this guy chain smoking on TV with this giant tan, open shirt with chains, and he was this cocky guy in this show, Can You Top This? And he was out there, and I was like, that's the life I want. I don't know why, but I was just connected with him.
So you always wanted to be in show business?
Yeah. Even as a kid, I did.
When did you start doing stand-up?
Late, when I was like 24.
Uh-huh. So what had you done before?
I just knocked around, bartended. I talked about being an actor. I worked for the Department of Employment. I went to college for 2 years. I went to... I was scared to do stand-up, really. I was scared.
Now, you mentioned earlier that in writing the book, the coloring book, you also were writing it as a way of doing stand-up. So did the jokes from the book in a stand-up routine?
Yes, a lot of them. Not as much as you would think. Like, there's all these stories in the book about me when I kind of fancied myself in the late 70s, early 80s is kind of do you know J.P. Dunleavy, the mm-hmm. Ginger Man? Like, that was my Bible, but I kind of tried to live that way. And I did a worse job at it than him, which is pretty hard to do.
Well, he has a castle in Ireland.
Oh, geez, he does. All right, well, I just lived the life that he lived, supposedly, just waking up on the gutter, you know, and I was a bartender. And so that was my whole thing was, what was that? I forget the question now.
Who knows? Oh, how'd you get into stand-up finally? It took you a long time.
Yeah.
Considering the fact that you had said you wanted to do it from a very early age.
Yeah. Well, I was scared to do it. And then when I stopped drinking in like 1983 or 84, and then I realized I have nothing left to do. You know what I mean? Like, that was my best. I love drinking. I love going to bars more than anything. And when I had to give up drinking, I had nothing to lose. And it didn't matter anymore.
So you could become addicted to getting laughs, can't you?
Yeah. It's probably saved my life.
Now, you said that audiences all over the country laugh at the same jokes. It's not like you got to fashion it for Omaha and then for Phoenix, Arizona.
For my jokes, anyway, they laugh at them. I don't know if everybody could apply, but they definitely look at, you can feel the audience wondering where you're going with this. Like when I do a show about the Constitution, you can feel people in Virginia or Georgia, when I'm talking about the Second Amendment, they're like, oh, where's this going? You know what I mean? Because they're so used to hearing one point of view and it's not theirs that they're a little bit like, you can tell they're just like, it just gets quiet in certain areas and different things. But jokes are jokes, you know?
Do you think that people are yearning for less political correctness, which is the reason that Donald Trump has become so popular?
Absolutely. I mean,
in some circles, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, his voice is so refreshing, even though what he's saying is insane. It's like, people are like, oh my God, somebody giving their actual opinion instead of a slick prepackaged kind of thing, you know, even though the opinion is like, what? What do you mean?
But well, comics used to have funny hairstyles.
But I mean,
now it's politicians.
Yeah. But even, I mean, even the fact that what he said about McCain still keeps his popularity shows people want a fresh voice. Nobody can agree with that. This guy got 5 deferments, and he's talking about a guy who was in a POW camp and wouldn't leave because his guys were there. It's insane. That's the most ludicrous thing I've heard. It's almost like people are like, wow, just the nerve that he's going to stand by this statement that we all know is obviously the complete opposite of the truth. You have to, you know what I mean? But it does speak to something else, I believe, which is people are sick and tired of like the kind of slick, everybody just speaking these basic, you know, generalized, bromide, whatever, you know.
Do you consider Amy Schumer a kindred spirit? She's also been criticized for making politically incorrect jokes.
Oh, a kindred spirit to me, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, of course. I mean, everybody in comedy I consider a kindred spirit, you know. It's like, she's, it was some insane article in the Washington Post that was, you know, drawing a parallel between her jokingly making these little racial remarks and Charleston shooting. And it's like, you know what I mean? All right, you want to play like that? Jesus, you know. And then the Washington Post prints it, which is what really makes me mad, you know.
Well, the man who shot up the theater showing Trainwreck, which you
appear
in, he was anti-feminist.
Yeah.
So he saw her as a feminist comedian.
Yeah. Yeah, she has a feminist streak to her, sure.
Did it feel natural to play her messed up father?
Once she forced me into it, yes, it did.
She forced you to do that?
Totally forced me. I was like, look, I'm not going to play her father. I'm too young. She goes, no, you're not. I go, yeah. And Amy, the thing about Amy is not only is she really funny and smart and like really, like there's 10 ways I could talk about how brilliant, but she doesn't take no for an answer. She had it in her mind that I was going to play that part. And she just pushed it with me and Judd until it happened. And I'm so grateful now. But at the time, believe me, I was resisting the whole way.
I hear she had an unusual response to your book being published.
Yeah, here's what I call a real comedian. She goes in the middle of the busiest time of her life. She's doing all this press, all this stuff. She's running around the country, running around Australia. She takes time out the day my book came out to get a copy of the book. I don't know who got it for her, but she thought of getting a copy of my book, brings it to her sister's house, and puts it under their dog and waits for the dog and somehow talks the dog into crapping on the book and takes it Instagram and sends it to me.
Now, your previous show, Colin Quinn Unconstitutional, was taped for broadcast.
Yeah.
But it'll be on Netflix on August 15th.
On Netflix, August 15th.
That's a day before this show ends its run.
Oh, nice. I guess, or terrible, I don't know.
Well, it just means that you'll have a kind of extended run of shows.
Yes.
Are you going to take this anywhere else?
This New York story? No.
Yeah.
You saw it, you know, it can't be anywhere else.
It has to be at the Cherry Lane.
I mean, it can't be. I mean, yeah, you mean like moving to Broadway and set now? I mean, it might extend. We're trying to extend it through through Christmas, but it doesn't belong anywhere else.
Can you ever imagine moving back to Brooklyn?
Sure. I could, but it would break. It would make me so mad. I'm sure you've had the same experience when we think of all the real estate things we've given up to pay that much money to live, and you're like, I could have had that. The Jackie Mason used to do a joke about people walk around New York and they go, do you know what that could have got that building for? So it's the same thing. I feel frustrated just thinking about it.
Are there certain neighborhoods that you are more attracted to?
Yeah, Park Slope. I mean, Park Slope. Just
go back.
Yeah, just to go home, you know. But, yeah, that's the one.
You and your book talk about how you can you write in the book about how you can see the foundation of social media sites in different ethnicities. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, that was a bit of a stretch off the bag, but I was just trying to correlate like Facebook with Puerto Ricans because they're updating you all the time. Like they're very interactive when they're having conversations with you, and they're just dealing with they update you on their family, on their friends, and what party they went to, who are the kids, who their relationship status. So I was kind of doing it, and Jews being Yelp because they're always get, but they only do it interactively with each other. So like if I tell a Jewish friend of mine like, hey, you know, this is a good play or movie, they don't listen. But if somebody else Jewish tells them, then they'll be like, all right, the word gets out.
Well, there's also the matter of being able to tell an offensive joke to your own group being acceptable. But
right.
Then somebody else tells you that joke and it's offensive.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it's the way you tell it. I mean, some people do mean offense when they tell a joke about another group. We've all heard it. And some people don't, you know.
Well, they're usually on the police department in Ferguson, Ohio.
Ferguson,
Missouri.
And it's like, yeah, I mean, it depends on who's, yeah, it's all context, you know, but I mean, but I feel like context is getting cut more and more into subjective, you know, group, and the people that are trying to stop stand-up are usually very not humorous people.
So where do you go from here? Now you have a book, you have a movie, you have this one-man show. You have any other worlds to conquer?
Well, I have a show on YouTube called Cop Show that I love doing, which is like my response to never being on Law and Order. So it's like all these episodes of me as the star of the cop show, even though it's just me fighting with all my friends.
And have you shot this year's series?
No, we shot 8 episodes. There were like 5-minute episodes. It's on YouTube. And then we're going to do it in L Studios. And then I'm going to do a bunch more in September.
But meanwhile, you can see Colin Quinn in Colin Quinn, The New York Story, which he has written and stars in at the Cherry Lane Theater at 38 Commerce Street. For ticket information, you can go to our show page at WMYC.org. And it's running through August 16th, although there is talk about extending it. You can see him in Amy Schumer and Judd Apatow's hit movie Trainwreck. And you could read his book, The Coloring Book, which is published by Grand Central Publishing. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Leonard.